Donald Trump is a convicted felon. It took a jury of 12 just 2 days to find the former president guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying business records brought against him by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg. To help us understand the verdict, I convened Kyle Chaney, senior legal affairs reporter, and Ankush Karduri, senior staff writer and columnist for Politico magazine, who, along with the entire Politico legal affairs team, have provided superlative coverage of this trial from the very beginning. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. All right, so Kyle, you were inside the courtroom today. Let's start with you and just set the scene for us as the jury entered the room to deliver this verdict.
The moment really started just before they came in, because everyone was packing up to go home for the day. We were all convinced that, I mean, there had been no word from the jury at all, and the judge Juan Merchan even said, "We're going home. We're going to send the jury home at 4:30. They're not going to have a decision today." He left to go check on them, and then he was gone for a while. And we were all like, "What's taking so long?" Suddenly, he comes back and says, "Actually, we're not going home today. There's a verdict." So it was this kind of whiplash moment that I think added to the suspense and the drama of it, which was already high, of course. But then, of course, you had the jury come out, and they confirmed they had reached their verdict.
Got it. Explain to people your vantage point watching this unfold.
Sure. So I was in the overflow room of the courthouse, which is where the majority of the press corps is situated. There are some people in the courtroom itself. But in fact, I actually prefer the overflow room because you have a screen where you can see Donald Trump's face. You can't see the jurors. You can't see the jury by design, but you can see Donald Trump. And so the biggest thing is, what's his reaction to this going to be? You're not seeing the jury, but you're hearing the judge address them and say, "You've reached a verdict." They confirm that. And then they just went through very businesslike, orderly, one by one, count one, guilty, count two, guilty. And of course, the first one is the moment, because that's the once, you know, it doesn't really, almost doesn't matter what happened to the other 33 counts, though they all turned out to be guilty. But you get the first one, you say, he's a convicted felon now. That is sort of the history of that moment, and the power of that moment was immediate. And of course, you could feel it in the courthouse because it was so tense.
Wow. The advantage of that room you were in is that you have a line onto Trump's reaction. Mm-hmm. What was your memory of how he reacted, and anything else mm-hmm. you saw in the first seconds after they said guilty?
You know, similar to the whiplash that we felt, it was actually what even added to that was that Trump, moments before the judge came back and said there's a verdict, he seemed in the best spirits we've seen him in all the entire trial. He was laughing, talking, you know, very animatedly with his lawyers, but seemed happy. And I think because in that moment when they thought the jury was going home for the day, he's starting to maybe get a little hope that they're not on the same page. And so the abrupt change for him was also apparent when he suddenly went quiet and was not, you know, having this happy animated conversation anymore. And I think he was realizing what was coming. And then immediately after the verdict, now he didn't have a huge reaction. There was sort of, I think, a bit of a wince. You know, he was staring intently at the jury as this verdict was being read. So that was the most notable thing, was he just locked on. And then after all 34 counts were read, he kind of looked straight ahead and seemed to be sort of lost in a moment of thought, you know, maybe contemplating what had just happened. And then the judge asked each individual juror to confirm that they agreed with the verdict. And so he looked back over at them and watched each one of them, and they all said, "Yes, we agree with that. That's the correct verdict." So that was kind of a powerful moment too.
Fascinating. All right, Ankush, let's talk about the case itself. I like having the two of you on because we're probably going to be as politics free as a conversation like this can be. Because I personally just don't think we know the political fallout here. So I want to start with this question: how did the prosecution win this case?
Gosh, well, I mean, look, it looks like they managed to win this case by persuading jurors that Michael Cohen was credible enough on the key elements of his testimony, including descriptions of some key conversations that he had with Trump for which there were no other witnesses. And also by, you know, shoring up his testimony by sort of beating home this theme that he was being corroborated by documents and other witnesses, text messages, financial records and things like that. And that was mostly true. It wasn't entirely true that his testimony could be fully corroborated by other evidence in the case, but a lot of it could. And, I think that that strategy looks like it paid off. I don't think it's actually much of a surprise. Well, it is a surprise anytime you get a jury note, but the fact that they asked about like circumstantial evidence in particular, I thought was a good sign for the prosecution, because that kind of was a key component of their case, which is, you know, presenting this as a story that just made logical sense and logically led to a conviction. I think that, you know, they had a pretty fulsome and consistent narrative that they sort of unspooled over the course of the trial. It had its gaps and weaknesses in my estimation, but it does appear to be the case that the jurors sort of accepted it.
Kyle, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think in addition, I think in the closing argument, they did a good job of, yes, shoring up Cohen's credibility, but also talking about how it was kind of in a weird way beside the point that there was so much corroborative evidence and documents that they should focus on. And then, as Ankush pointed out, the inferences they could draw, even just from the stuff that was independent of Cohen, that they could reach a conviction, they could reach a guilty verdict without too much of Cohen, needing too much of Cohen. And I thought, whether you buy that or not, because I actually think there were some aspects of the case that only Cohen could speak to, it was persuasive in the closing argument, and I think may have been effective with the jury.
This speaks to something, to what both of you just said. There was this moment where the jurors asked Judge Mershon to repeat his rain analogy. In hindsight, you know, these are things that are easier to understand in hindsight. That seemed to be a good clue about where this was going. Either of you want to explain what I'm talking about and its significance in hindsight?
Well, I mean, the judge offered, I don't remember the specifics. There are a variety of these very common metaphors that judges use to explain circumstantial evidence and inferences. Rain is one. I don't know exactly how to formulate it, but
I think it was basically like, well, you know, if you wake up and you don't see rain, but you see people with umbrellas and it's wet outside and they're wearing, you know, rain gear, you know, a fair inference is that it rained overnight.
Yeah. Or like you wake up and you see snow on the ground. Yes. A fair inference is that it snowed overnight. There are like a bunch of these.
It's funny, but when he started talking about circumstantial evidence, I looked to whoever was sitting next to me and I said, oh, they're going to do the snow analogy because I've heard you.
Common. Okay.
Yeah, it is very common.
Yeah.
And so was it a sign that the jury asked for that to be repeated? So this is a sign of what? That they were trying to make those inferences with the evidence that didn't require the Michael Cohen testimony?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I drew from. And look, we don't know how many people even had the question, right? For all we know, it was one juror who had the question, and the other juror
to
the judge in the hopes that
you don't have to be unanimous on the question that goes into the judge.
Correct. I did think it was a good sign for them. You know, obviously in hindsight, it's easy to say that. So I don't really want to oversell it, but it did seem to be like a positive indicator.
Well, but that point you make, Ankush, is interesting too, because I think there was so much psychoanalysis of the jurors and every little, every word of the question is, what does this mean? And you saw a lot of the pro-Trump people saying, oh, that question's good for Trump because it means someone is confused about the instructions or maybe not buying that they can make these inferences. So therefore, the other jurors said, hey, let's give the instruction again to try to convince this person that they can make those inferences.
It's a holdout.
In hindsight, I think that analysis is correct. But in the moment, we're saying, is it because someone's saying they can't make the inference and therefore is holding out or what? And maybe that was true. Maybe there were a couple jurors who said, I'm a little uncomfortable about that. And they said, we'll show you. We'll read the instruction again and you'll see that you can do it.
All right, Ankush, this is a subject that's near and dear to your heart, I believe. And that is, the flip side is, how did the defense blow this?
All right. I think that, again, like, hindsight is 20/20. So I don't want to oversell this, because lawyers, this is actually like a very similar to like the end of a political campaign, right? Where everybody sort of retroactively decides like that the winner was a genius the whole time and the loser was destined to lose the whole time.
Totally.
Same thing kind of happens in a trial too. So I don't want to oversell it, but I do think, like, even in the moment, as the pretrial proceedings and the trial proceedings unfolded, there were just some very conspicuous missteps. In the run-up to the trial, I mean, they just could not stop talking in their court filings about how they thought that Donald Trump was being persecuted by the Democrats and the Biden administration, this, that, or the other. That was for public consumption, obviously. But it went to the judge, too. And it made all of their briefs weaker and easier to kind of set to the side. And also, look, this was a complicated case with lots of intricate sort of pieces that provided some novel legal issues. I never felt like the briefs actually did a particularly effective job, the defense's briefs, a particularly effective job of explaining just how much there was in the way of sort of new prosecutorial sort of imagination here, if you will. Not to suggest that it was inappropriate or anything, but a lot of this was untested in the architecture of the legal case. Then as we got to the trial, you know, I did a whole column on this. I mean, it was just completely idiotic for Todd Blanche, Trump's lead counsel, to deny that Trump had a sexual encounter with Stormy Daniels. I mean, they were just asking to get beaten over the head with her testimony. That's exactly what happened. Throughout, you know, there were also these cross-examinations of every single witness. Again, this is a very Trumpian strategy, right? You just have to, like, you know, attack everything. Don't, you know, deny everything. And, you know, the early witnesses, we'll take someone like Keith Davidson, who was Stormy Daniels' lawyer. He barely had any contact. I mean, he had no contact with Trump. His dealings were all through Michael Cohen. So, you know, the cross of him could have been, you know, how many times you talked to Donald Trump? Okay, zero. Thanks. Or some variation on that. You know, instead, it was like this whole thing about how he's a sleaze merchant and potentially extorted Trump and all that. And it was like, you know, that may be good for sort of the political theater, but it is not the way to defend a white collar case, mm-hmm. which usually requires some very strategic judgments about what to contest and what not to contest. And then we get to the cross of Michael Cohen, which I think was always sort of the main event in this case. And, you know, Cohen has just so much I've never seen a government witness in any serious criminal prosecution with as much material for a defense lawyer to work with as Michael Cohen.
Really? And, like, I mean, the people talk about, you know, Sammy the Bull Gravano putting away Gotti. He was a murderer. Worse than that kind of criminal?
I mean, like, in white collar cases, to be honest. I mean,
okay,
murderer is a way to, like, set to that to the side.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay.
He's lied to so many people. He's lied to every branch of the federal government. He's lied to his banks. He lied to the IRS. On the stand, he called the federal judge who's deceased, who sentenced him, corrupt, as well as the Southern District prosecutors, claimed he had been railroaded. He hadn't really done the things he did, but maybe also he did do some of the things he did. Anyway, he just provided an extraordinary amount of fodder for a defense witness, for a defense lawyer. And, you know, obviously he's had reams of material in the form of podcasts and television interviews that could have been used to cross him. And some of that was, at least the podcast stuff. But the cross itself, I mean, on paper, I thought Blanche actually did a good job of, like, kind of extracting some key points. And particularly, I mean, there's no denying, whatever the result was, the cross on the call to Keith Schiller and the revelation that it may have been about a 14-year-old kid harassing Michael Cohen, rather than Michael Cohen apprising Donald Trump about Stormy Daniels, that is an excellent cross-examination moment, despite the fact that they lost the case. You see, he pulled out that material, but, you know, and I heard this from people who were in the courtroom, and not political colleagues. I'm not going to rat any of them out. But I heard this from multiple people, that it was not landing because Blanche was all over the place. Mm-hmm. He didn't moderate his tone very well. You could see this on paper too, but it jumped around temporally, like in time and even thematically. And you have to pick one if you want jurors to follow what you're doing. A cross-examination either needs to move thematically or temporally or some combination thereof. So then, you know, we get to the closing arguments. And, you know, the column I did prior to the closing, I said correctly in my view, or at least that's what I truly believe, that this case could actually come down to the closing arguments. Because had the defense really rearranged all of the material from Cohen's cross and sort of jettisoned some of their silly mistakes, like denying the encounter with Stormy Daniels, they could have put together a very, very good closing. And then the closing, you know, I hate to, you know, beat down on the losing party here, but the closing was bad. It was really bad. It just rehashed everything that had come out on cross, and like then the full kind of arsenal of material that you could have deployed against someone against Michael Cohen at the close of a trial, again, having a week to prepare after the close of evidence, that just did not come through. The scuttlebutt, such as it is, I'll just give it to you. It's been going around among the legal analysts and commentators for the last week or two. I think the closing sort of solidified that Todd Blanche did not do his best work on this case, and that another set of lawyers plausibly could have gotten Trump off.
I want to ask Kyle about the complicated jury instructions that confused everyone earlier this week and gave the jurors this sort of these multiple options that people on the right found infuriating. Could you just explain that for us, Kyle?
Sure. And there was a lot of misinformation about them too and what they really meant. But it is complicated, and I think is a fair criticism of this case overall that they relied on this law that has so many layers and is somewhat untested in the way that it was used against Trump, that will be a matter on appeal, and I'm sure there may be a serious appeal. But the prosecutors had to show that Trump falsified the business records in order to in the commission of another crime. It's almost like Inception. There's like a few different layers of things they had to show, and the burden of proof on each is different.
Got it. So in other words, he broke New York election law, but by one of these three methods.
Right. There's a kind of a menu of ways in which the jury could have found that he attempted to do that that. And one of them,
and the jurors did not have to agree on which method.
And that's what became the firestorm on the right was, you know, because everyone is very familiar with the concept of jury unanimity to convict someone of a criminal offense and to potentially take away their liberty is you need this unanimity. It's got to be overwhelming. And that's true. And the judge was very clear. You need to unanimously agree that he falsified records. You need to unanimously agree that he violated New York State campaign finance law. What you don't need to unanimously agree on is how he attempted to violate New York State campaign finance law. There are several different ways the prosecutors offered to show that Trump attempted to do or intended to do that.
Got it. At the end of all this, Judge Juan Merchan he set sentencing for July 11th, which inconveniently is the day before my 50th birthday when I'm supposed to be on vacation. But perhaps more importantly for a lot of people, that's 4 days before the Republican National Convention starts in Milwaukee. Let's distill down everything we know about sentencing and what the sort of range of options are here. Ankush, do you want to start with that? The things that I tell me if I'm wrong about this, but the conventional wisdom I see among the legal analysts is on one side, it's a Class E felony in New York, that's minor, and most of the time there's no jail time. On the flip side, Trump was found to be in contempt of court 10 times during this trial. He was found guilty on all 34 counts. It doesn't seem like he's likely to show much remorse, and that weighs more towards the side of a stronger sentencing. What's your view of all this?
I think that is correct. I mean, so first of all, the maximum sentence on a charge that he's been convicted of, 4 years per count, they're not going to stack. So I would think the judge would be looking at it in terms of like at the max, thinking about this as a maximum 4 year term of imprisonment.
Not four times 34.
Right. No. For a first time offender in New York, where white collar defendants are treated pretty well by sentencing judges. And, you know, Trump has a history as serving as U.S. president, which is not nothing by any means, right? By any means. He would have a very good case for probation in the ordinary course. Or potentially getting off of some very combination of probation and fines or something like that. But to me, at least, the factor that I think like is the wild card here is his own behavior during the trial. And I'm sure we're going to see more of it after.
We saw it immediately after the verdict.
Yeah. I mean, he used every single day to rail against the judge and the case and that's all well and good, fine, rail away. But it was extremely dishonest, claiming that, you know, the case had been orchestrated by the Biden White House. It was political enemies coming after him. And, that undermines the New York criminal justice system and it undermines the integrity of the proceedings. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who are happy for that to have happened, but I guarantee you the judge was not happy for that to have happened. And one of the things he's supposed to do is to guard the integrity of the legal system, the court proceedings, and to promote respect for the law. So I don't know what he'll do, obviously, in terms of actually rendering a sentence. But if I were him, that part of it would give me very serious pause, because I would be thinking, it's all well and good that he's convicted on this. We don't usually give people prison time. That's very, very significant and important. But how can we let someone just treat the justice system this way? I literally cannot think of a precursor for the way in which Trump behaved. We'd have to go to mobsters, I guess. But even them, they don't get every day to speak to the national media and have their words broadcast throughout the country. That's what Trump did.
They often listen to their lawyers. Kyle, what do you think? Is Trump going to jail?
One factor here too is we're now over the next few weeks, we're going to see a bunch of filings and submissions, including from the DA, recommending a sentence, and Trump will actually have to sit for a probation interview with a probation official, who will also contribute to the, you know, a potential recommended sentence, which I'm trying to fathom the probation officer who gets picked for that job.
Wait, okay, so slow down here. Explain this. Okay, so the trial's over, the verdict's in immediately after they set the sentencing date. What happens between here and July 11th?
So Trump's team and the prosecutors will each submit a proposed sentencing recommendation. I'm not as familiar with the intricacies of the New York state process. I know, at least on the federal level, that they each sort of submit, and then in the probation department also submits its own recommendation. Mershon did talk about Trump sitting for a probation interview, which makes me think it'll be somewhat akin to that.
Wow. This just goes to show you how unsuited this process is for dealing with this kind of crime and defendant. Because, I mean, just imagine the probation officer who's got this on his schedule.
And, you know, and again, we'll see these filings get traded. Trump's going to have to go down to Florida for other hearings in his criminal case there. And he's got the Republican convention 4 days after his sentencing, and he'll actually receive the nomination six days or so later, which is sort of a remarkable juxtaposition that he'll be sentenced potentially to prison before he's the official GOP nominee. It's sort of hard to even process.
After he is sentenced on July 11th, and my understanding is he could file a motion to extend that date. So we'll have to watch to see what happens with that. Mm-hmm. So Ankush, the appeals can start after sentencing. What does that process look like? And is it likely that if he is sentenced, even if it's to community service or home confinement, whatever it is it very likely that that would be suspended during an appeal, or is that an open question?
So the process is, you know, it would follow a fairly standard process of just briefing through first the appellate division, which is the intermediate court in New York, and then potentially up through the Court of Appeals. And it would be briefs and potentially oral arguments at the judge's discretion. Although I'd imagine on this, there would be oral arguments. In terms of whether or not he would be allowed to sort of suspend his sentence, so to speak, pending appeal, I'm sure he will ask. I do not know if it will be granted. I do think he would have a pretty good argument under the circumstances, simply because there are some novel legal issues here. And that tends to be the best argument for defendants to stay out pending appeal, which is to say, like, you don't quite know how this is going to resolve itself. And particularly when the sentence might be shorter, significantly shorter than the time it would take for the appeal to run. Meaning, like, if the guy might be sentenced like 2 or 3 months, and we're talking about a years long appeals process, you know, the sentence could be served by the time the appeal is over. So, which is not a great situation. So, I think he'll have a pretty good argument in this case, but I don't know how it'll unfold.
Kyle, what do you think the best avenues for an appeal are? And Ankush, feel free to jump in as well.
Yep. There are a couple, and I think one is what we talked about earlier, which is they're going to challenge this idea that the unlawful means that the jury could choose from that menu of choices to decide how Trump violated campaign finance law was not unanimous. They'll say that that's a violation of Supreme Court precedent. Ankush may have a better grasp on whether that's even plausible. I think that's talking point 1A for them on appeal. Then I think there's also going to be some question about some of the testimony that came in from Stormy Daniels and whether it was prejudicial in the sense that it wasn't related to the actual crime itself, the charges themselves. Even the judge got upset at a couple points when the prosecutors kept eliciting testimony from her that was really salacious. It's sort of fortuitous for Trump that the High Court in New York ruled that Harvey Weinstein, his conviction, he should be retried in part because his trial was prejudiced by similar evidence coming in that shouldn't have come in that may have been inflammatory and prejudiced the jury. I don't think these are analogous cases in any respect, but Trump's people are very well aware of that ruling and might point to it to say hurt Stormy Daniels' testimony was so prejudicial, he should get a new trial at least.
Yeah, I guess I agree with Kyle. It does seem to be some of the avenues that they're pursuing. They don't sound terribly promising to me, those particular two. And I'll take them one at a time. The structure of the decision-making that the jury did here sort of is he guilty of this offense and providing multiple means by which you could reach that conclusion without the jurors having to agree on which means. It is extremely common criminal cases, in particular conspiracy cases. Because oftentimes the charge is just going to be the conspiracy. The prosecutors will allege multiple manners and means, meaning the ways in which the conspiracy was effectuated, or potentially multiple overt acts, depending on what part of the charge we're talking about. And the jurors don't have to agree on those things either. They just have to, each one of them just has to agree, you know, there was a manner and means that was used to pursue the conspiracy. They don't have to agree on which one. So I would be surprised if that had legs legally, but, you know, New York courts can surprise from time to time. I do understand why Trump and his supporters have tried to mislead the public into thinking that this is unusual because it sounds counterintuitive, but is in fact quite common in the criminal system. As for the analogy to the Weinstein case, I completely agree with Kyle. There are significant differences. I mean, the most obvious one, which I think just is the whole ball game to me at least, is that the Weinstein conviction was overturned because there was testimony from women accusing Weinstein of misconduct that had not been charged in the case, meaning it was extrinsic to the charges that had actually been brought. In this case, we're not talking about a totally different witness being allowed to testify about some other event. We're talking about a single witness potentially offering some extraneous details, which is very different in kind. The issues that I think like actually might have some legs are the issues surrounding like the interaction between New York and federal law. Like, you know, let's say that, you know, for instance, as Kyle mentioned, you know, the crime that elevated this from a misdemeanor to a felony was this New York state law that prohibits promoting the election of someone through unlawful means. The unlawful means included potential violations of federal campaign and finance law. Is that a permissible object of a New York criminal statute of that nature? Can that object of that statute be a federal offense, or does that sort of overlap with federal jurisdiction in the area and campaign finance law more generally? That is an actual intricate issue that I don't think is particularly well resolved in New York courts. And also this question of, like, what does it mean to have the intent to commit another crime? You know, that was hotly contested in the run-up to the jury instructions. And, you know, that there too, actually, this was acknowledged explicitly during the charging conference, is an area where there was really not much guidance for the parties to work with in terms of figuring how to instruct the jury. And that, you know, can be an area of vulnerability on appeal as a result.
All right, gentlemen, my last question here is that now that Donald Trump is a convicted felon, what are all the ways in which being a convicted felon will affect his life? And I mean from his ability to vote, to any other kind of restrictions like that, to what it might mean for the other three cases that are still ongoing, although, as Kyle wrote today and has written previously, are unlikely to get resolved before the election. What's about asking you the political question that, you know, we're all going to be debating over the next few weeks in terms of what this means for the election, but what does it mean to be a convicted felon for him? Kyle, you want to start?
Good question. I think being a convicted felon for Trump is going to mean something different than it would for most people in the world, as a lot of things are. You know,
it's going to mean he's going to raise a lot of money.
Right. Exactly. I got a text message while we're on this podcast, in which I'm a political prisoner. You know, donate here. And yeah. You know, I think they'll make hay out of this for a while. In part because what we just talked about. You know, there's a good chance this sentence will be suspended pending appeal. And he may not feel a real consequence from this for quite a while. That said, he's not going to be the typical convicted felon who has too many restrictions on his travel or his movements. I'm very curious how they factor in, because the court system is not supposed to factor in the political side of things, whether they account for the fact that he'll be in the home stretch of a campaign when his sentence is supposed to be effectuated. And that actually trying to sentence him to prison in that moment might be, have bigger repercussions than just putting someone in jail.
August?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Kyle. I mean, look, in the ordinary course, you know, there might be some collateral effects in terms of, like, his ability to vote in Florida. I know that there's a story on that we have up on that subject on the site. And, you know, other than that, right, like, what does it mean to be a felon? Well, it's usually harder to get a job if you're looking for a job, but he's not going to have that problem. It's supposed to be a huge stigma and an embarrassing thing, but we'll see if that that is the case here. Certainly, he's not going to present himself as someone feeling like he's suffered some actual stigma. So, and I agree with Kyle, I wouldn't expect much in the way of, like, any types of restrictions on his movements or anything like that, or any sort of particularly onerous conditions on him, you know, but, you know, we'll see. I mean, it may be that, you know, if the judge decides to sentence him to some form of probation, that, you know, he does impose or attempt to impose some constraints along those lines in order to sort of make it a little bit more burdensome than, you know, just probation might ordinarily be. But, you know, the practical effects, you know, I agree with Kyle. I don't think those are going to materialize, at least the worst ones, just yet, and not until the appeals process plays out. And, like, if he's in office when that happens, then I don't think there will really be any effect.
I think it goes away. I was just going to make that point that I think, you know, there's a constitutional argument that constraints put on him by a state court, would be unconstitutional while he's president. He has duties to the country that require him to be uninhibited and unshackled from certain restrictions that probation might impose, and they would supersede anything that the state, any interest the state might have in effectuating its sentence immediately. In Georgia, Trump said if he's elected, the trial there should be postponed until 2029. I think they'd make a similar argument for the effectuation of a sentence in New York.
Yeah, and I would say, like, I know a lot of people like to fantasize about, like, I don't mean that pejoratively, but sincerely, like, fantasize about, like, oh, could he be president from prison? That would be bad for the country, mm-hmm. right? Whatever one thinks about Donald Trump, like him or dislike him, his worst impulses would just get worse if he had to do it to serve as a president from prison. So I
from
just
prison?
That is not
yeah.
going to happen. Yeah,
doesn't right? seem like a good thing.
Exactly, yeah. It'd be bad for
he
all
would,
of us.
Yeah, he would have to declare like what gang he joined, and
and I mean, I just the president has to conduct foreign policy. That means going around and meeting world leaders. You can't do that.
I was going to say, where are they going to set up a situation room there,
right.
like down the hall in Rikers or something? So, I just think that's practically inconceivable. And the legal argument that Kyle sketched out is, I think, the one that would be the principal one.
Yeah. So not completely out of the realm of possibility that the Supreme Court has to think through an issue like this at some point in the near future.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point, actually. It's possible that Trump tries to go from, if he keeps losing on appeal, we'll see, but he tries to take it from the New York state court system after losing at the Court of Appeals to even to the Supreme Court. So, I mean, there's a lot of string left to play here. And of course, you know, we're not dwelling on the politics here, but, you know, November is really going to be crucial in terms of whether and to what extent this process really plays out to its natural conclusion.
Kyle Ankush, thank you so much for helping us break all this down and for all your coverage of the trial. Hope you guys get a little bit of rest this weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.